Okay, so I'm going to tell you about another interesting problem of entanglements in polyelectrolytes. And it's actually, of course, a great pleasure to be here talking to all of you. But it's not really a talk that I like, because I really try to avoid these talks that make me look like a confused experimentalist. You know, it's just bad for one's career or whatever. I think it's perfectly fine for Scott, being a theorist, you know, to come up here and point out all the things we don't understand. But for me, I'm not completely comfortable with it. Mainly, you know, I actually go to great pains to try to avoid this situation, actually. I mean, much to the chagrin of my students, I'll sit on data for many years just because I don't happen to
All those hackers in Europe
Staring
at their computer screens can't hear you. Well, you sort that out.
Right. All right. Okay. So you know, we go to great pains to try to avoid this situation and actually sit on data for long times, and then in other situations, you know, really kowtow to the theorists. And Michael showed an example yesterday where I actually took theorists fishing. I mean, this is really a bad idea. Theorists are notoriously bad luck. In fact, there were two other theorists with us that particular day, and we didn't catch a thing. I think the only other time I took theorists fishing, I took Itzhak Rabin fishing off of Boston Harbor, and the engine died about 4 miles offshore. So that was an interesting afternoon. Okay, so polyelectrolyte entanglement, I think I'll start with just what we think we know about polymer entanglement in general, and maybe start out with a real experimentalist caveat, is that it seems absolutely remarkable that we've gotten so far with tube models and whatnot, models of entangled polymers, without actually putting our finger on what an entanglement really is. And that's partly because we don't have the experimental tools to go into an entangled liquid and look at things very carefully. But also, even if we did have the tool that would let us go in and look, we don't know really what to look for. So, so here's my view of what we know about entanglements in uncharged polymers. So in polymer melts, we essentially have what I call an overlap criterion, that you need a certain number of other chains inside of an entanglement volume that's the volume of the cube of the tube diameter. And this number n is obviously easily calculated, because V0 is the volume of a Kuhn monomer, and NE is the number of Kuhn monomers in an entanglement strand. And so the ratio of A cubed and V0 over NE gives us this number of chains in this volume. And so this idea is quite old, talked about by Kavassalis and Nulandi, Lin, and Lou Fetters. It's basically an issue about packing. Scott talked about this packing length, but it's sort of a dense crowding issue where we have to pack all these other chains around each other. And it really points to the fact why we don't have really a universal way of thinking about entanglements with a simple scaling idea, because there's two length scales. There's this Kuhn length, and then there's some sort of width of the Kuhn segment. And whenever you have two length scales, your scaling is going to have trouble unless you start making conjectures. So the conjecture in the case of melts that seems to work is this overlap idea, and it gives us a modulus. The plateau modulus is just kT per entanglement strand. That shows up sort of everywhere in this talk. So we divide by the volume of an entanglement strand, which is the volume of a Kuhn monomer times the number of Kuhn monomers in an entanglement strand, NE. Yes?
This paper by Nulandi, what year is that, do you know?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. I bet somebody in the audience knows the answer to this question. It's something like late 80s, yeah.
There's a paper in the 70s by Jacques Rolle where he outlines this prescription.
Okay.
I think 73 something. It might have been the first.
Could be. I don't know this paper.
Jacques Rolle, I don't know him.
Yeah, I'd like to get this reference from you. Okay, so it's actually amazing. I mean, Fetters has shown that this N of 20 seems to work amazingly well for zillions of different polymer melts. And so this seems to be some sort of universal number. When we move on to solutions, we don't have this crowding issue anymore. When we talk about solutions, then we have to just think about sort of the odds of getting a pairwise contact between two different chains. And so actually in a good solvent, this turns out to be the same sort of overlap criterion, mainly because these length scales, the tube diameter and the correlation length in semi-dilute solution, have the same scaling. So that means that, for instance, the osmotic pressure and the plateau modulus then are proportional to one another, and both scale like phi to the 9/4. In theta solvent, things are a little bit more complicated because the correlation length effectively measures distance between ternary contacts in a theta solvent. So remember, if you expand the osmotic pressure, the phi squared term in theta solvent, of course, drops out because the excluded volume is zero. And so you wind up with this phi cube thing that's effectively measuring ternary contacts. But of course, the binary contacts are still there. They didn't disappear in a theta solvent. And they affect things like modulus. In fact, there are many more binary contacts in the solution than there are ternary contacts. So the plateau modulus is then still, in both of these cases, is kT per entanglement strand. So this is the volume of an entanglement strand. It's A squared times the correlation length. And in that case, it works out to be something like 7/3 power of volume fraction. So any questions about this one? Yes. I don't have a way to explain it. I don't think it's actually observed experimentally, though. People tend to... I've seen some plots where people tend to say, well, it looks like it's phi cubed at some higher concentration. But then if you put the melt value of the plateau modulus on the same plot, then you'd be inclined to draw a power law, which is much more consistent with these, which actually these exponents are essentially the same. And in fact, if you put the nu of 0.588 instead of 3/5, this thing comes out to be 2.31, and this one's 2.33. So that's the same as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Okay. So in polyelectrolytes, we don't worry about this issue, because we think that we have a situation where the overlap and the pairwise contacts ideas should agree, because the tube diameter and the correlation length are essentially the same. But the idea doesn't work, so in the end we'll have to pitch it for something, but I don't replace it with anything. That's what I don't like about the talk. Okay, so we have the same n strands in a volume A cubed, and we can calculate that rather easily because, let's see, there will be a certain number of strands, which is just the, any is the number of monomers in an entanglement strand, and G is the number of monomers in a correlation volume. So the entanglement strand is made up of many correlation blobs, and that ratio then tells you the number of blobs in that strand, and that's just given by random walk statistics. So it's A over C squared. So that's one equation that we'll need.
And
G is the number of monomers in a correlation blob of size C. And the second equation then is this one that we had on the previous overhead, actually, that we can figure out n from the ratio of the cube of the tube diameter and the volume of a single entanglement strand, which is C cubed times NE over G, because NE over G is the number of blobs in a single entanglement strand. So we can combine those two things and wind up with this number of monomer or number of entanglement strands in the entanglement volume as just the ratio of the tube diameter and the correlation length. So the simplest thing to assume is just like we had in good solvent for uncharged polymers, or we have in a polymer melt, and that is that there will be some constant n. And if we assume that there's a constant n, of course, then the tube diameter and the correlation length have to have the same concentration dependence. And the correlation length was the concentration dependence of the correlation length was actually predicted by Degen in 1976. It goes as the reciprocal square root of concentration. And that's actually very well established experimentally for polyelectrolytes. So if we have then the situation where we have the tube diameter proportional to the correlation length, it means that the entanglement concentration has to then be proportional to the overlap concentration. And it works out that it's actually n to the fourth times the overlap concentration, which would suggest that, okay, well, the overlap concentration, of course, for polyelectrolytes goes like 1 over n squared, because it's always n over r cubed, and polyelectrolytes are rod-like in dilute solution, so it goes like 1 over n squared. And this n to the fourth means that we expect a very wide range where the polyelectrolyte solutions are semi-dilute, but they're not really entangled.
Sorry,
what is C sub E? Yeah, C sub E is the entanglement concentration. Right.
And what's the general expression for C sub E?
General expression for C sub E. What do you mean?
That's a question for later. Can I still be confused? Because say you calculate the overlap concentration by assuming that they are essentially spread, but then here you go on to say that beyond the log level, they are again random walk.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the configuration of the polyelectrolyte chain in semi-dilute solution is that it's essentially rod-like up to the correlation length, and then it's a random walk of these correlation volumes.
Which is not true. They're not
rod-like. Yeah, well, they're certainly not rigid sticks, right? You don't want to have this. It's a directed random walk. Okay.
But that is an assumption, right? That this persistence length is just the blob size.
Yeah, that's right. And in principle, it's not necessarily numerically equal to the blob size, but we expect it to have the same concentration dependence. But that's an important issue, actually, that may come up toward the end, too. Okay, so if we compare what I call uncharged polymers always in good solvent with polyelectrolytes, Of course, the overlap concentration is much lower for polyelectrolytes because they're highly extended in dilute solution. Because of this n to the fourth, we have a wide range that's semi-dilute but not entangled, which means that the entanglement concentration is much larger than the overlap concentration. So it's something of the order of 1,000 times larger, which means that much of the experimentally relevant range for polyelectrolytes is actually in this semi-dilute unentangled regime, whereas for good solvents of neutral polymers, it's a fairly small regime. Yeah. Well, you need a certain number of chains inside of an entanglement volume to call them entangled, right? And the real issue is that this, the coil size is contracting much, much faster than it does ordinarily, right? So this rapid decrease in size, it means that things are shrinking as we're concentrating them, and it postpones entanglements by that criterion to
the physics of the shrinking of the size, is that because they're physically colliding these sticks and they can bend them and do, or is it because it's something about the electrostatics?
No, I think it's electrostatics. In other words, we're dealing with inherently flexible chains like sulfonated polystyrene that once they start overlapping each other, they screen each other's electrostatic interactions, and that's why the chain conformation changes from a rod-like thing inside the correlation length to just a random walk beyond the correlation.
Right. That statement that you just made me think, but there's no cartoon for me to check, that if I'm walking along a given chain, though per objective this, that I would be going straight for a while, and then I'd have a close encounter with another chain and make a bend and so forth, and it would be a random walk in that sense, locally straight, but making sense. So I might have called that a collision, even though it's electrostatics.
Okay, it's hard to say, because at least in this scaling model, the distance between chains is the same as the screening one. So.
You think that you have some simulations which would not be implicit in that picture, or you know the simulation for data which are not implicit in the picture?
When you look at simulations, we have changed the presence of a simple system just for ions and look at the conformation of the object as a function of concentration. You never find if we detect objects in the first place. And then when you increase the concentration, you have a huge regime, you have a chain significantly shrink before they actually start to overlap. What you essentially have is you have an object with the whole ground compound. And this is pressure together, essentially like the other one. And within this more or less spherical regime, the chain is not at all work like. You have effectively forming something like 1.75 to 8 or so.
You mean there are markers even simulations as well as somebody else? Or
what's the mark of markers?
If you come in and down those positions on the chain,
Right,
and that gives you a drifting correction here that explains the effect of ownership.
No, but the but the question is a very important one actually, because since we don't really have a model of polyelectrolyte statics that everyone agrees on, it's a little bit difficult to go on to try to understand dynamics. But anyway, I want to not spend a lot of time on this overhead actually, but basically there's regimes of unentangled polyelectrolytes that where Rouse-like things happen, right? So the modulus is KT per chain, and then there's a regime of entangled polyelectrolytes, and the relaxation time, the viscosity, the diffusion coefficient, the modulus all change their concentration dependencies rather strongly. It really is a Rouse-like regime, and actually, I mean, for uncharged polymers, it's always hard to sort of sit at a concentration that's cleanly in this regime, right? Because these concentrations are so close to each other. But for this one, it's really easy. You can go and see how things change with concentration, even. And it really is Rouse-like. That's shown from these data by Eric Amos. Where they fit their data for different molecular weights and different concentrations of polyelectrolytes all onto this universal Rouse-like scaling. They call it the Zim bead spring model, but it's really only Zim when this H parameter is 1, and it's Rouse when the H parameter is 0, so it's very close to the Rouse limit of this sort of generalized bead spring model. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about two data from two polymers that we've studied quite a lot, not just my group, but other people around the world too. So one is called, I call sodium PAMS because the real name for this thing is too complicated for me. But it's basically a sulfonated polymer with a sodium counterion. And the other one is sulfonated polystyrene, which looks a little more familiar to most of you, I think. So I just want to tell you what those acronyms that you'll see mean. That's right, which is not always the case that there's no salt, but there's definitely no added salt. In fact, we've gone to great pains to try to get rid of the salt. But there, you'll see in a little bit, there is some salt sometimes. Okay, so one thing we want to check is whether the overlap concentration, since this is supposed to be proportional to the entanglement concentration, whether this thing really goes like 1 over n squared, which of course, if it does, would make this discussion about rod-like things rather moot. And in fact, it does go like 1 over n squared experimentally. So these are data for from X-ray scattering, where essentially the correlation length that you measure, well, the apparent, the peak in the scattering function that you measure in dilute solution scales like C to the 1/3, and in semi-dilute solution scale, it's the correlation length that scales like C to the 1/2, and so the place where they break is a good definition of C star, and that's these data all up here, and then we can just choose the point where the viscosity is twice the solvent viscosity is an estimate of C star for higher molecular weight polyelectrolytes. And here's a lot of different data from the literature for sulfonated polystyrene. It seems to agree reasonably well. But now we expect the entanglement concentration to be proportional to this, but higher, right? So it should be out here somewhere, n to the 4th times higher, and n is some number of order 10 or something. Yes. Yeah.
And compare this to the real extension of the chain, which in a simulation you can separately look at. Then you see that the system is still way in the dilute regime.
Way in the dilute regime.
I mentioned before that the chains restart the cleaning before they really overlap. They're still by far too small to be really overlapped. It will really have significant overlap.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's a transition regime which goes. Our data, right? About a decade or two in
A decade or two in density. So a decade below what you would call the overlap concentration is where this stuff starts.
You see the change in the cube behavior, in the density behavior of the SOC.
Okay, yeah, I didn't realize it was that big, but...
Probably the change would be difficult. So the bank loans on the end is now something that's been handled.
Yeah, but practically speaking, if this point is lower than the point where the chains start to overlap, I'm going to call this lower point the overlap concentration, right? I mean, but I think that would show up in both of these experiments, right? It's sort of when the chains start to interact with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was that difficult to measure the molecular weight and viscosity. What's varying across those things, viscosity and all that scatter?
I think what's varying is amounts of residual salt. Yeah. Because look, these concentrations are getting to be ridiculously small, right? Yeah. No, I think the. Yeah, it's not so easy though, right? Because the amounts of salt are, you know, the salt is basically coming from dissolved and dissociated carbon dioxide.
Is that
right?
All that concentration or what?
Yeah, this is moles of monomer per liter, right? So these are really low concentrations. They're, you know, so I put this at the bottom. One part per million by weight is 5 times 10 to the minus 6 molar.
So where is then the filing of the system compared to the expansion of the system? From a higher molecular weight, so it must be the door or even smaller.
The divide length in dilute solution, you mean? Well, how extended these things are.
Correct.
No, but it's sort of something like a third of the fully extended length of the chain.
That means you need the bilengths way above 1,000 angstroms. That means extremely
few. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, those are all interesting issues that don't have so much to do with the point I want to make, because the point I want to make is that the entanglement concentration is really nothing like what we expected. So it is above the overlap concentration, which I guess is a good thing, but it doesn't have anything like. So what we were expecting is something like this. It doesn't have any character or anything like this. So I've got different colors from different experiments. These ones come from viscosity, where the viscosity breaks from the Fuas law scaling of C to the 1/2 to C to the 3/2. But then also data from Ustwal for the same polymers from diffusion coefficient, and then one from our rheology measurements from relaxation time. For my money, diffusion coefficient and relaxation time ought to be about the same measure. And clearly, there's a much weaker scaling, something like n to the minus 0.6. And I don't have an explanation for that. So Tom has promised to answer any questions that I raise. Sorry? No, the vertical axis is the same scale. So now I'm not plotting C star, I'm plotting CE, are these points.
So they differ by about 5 to 10?
Yeah. In some cases, I mean, for For high molecular weight polymers, they're differing by a lot, like our model naively thought, right? But as we go to smaller chain lengths, they're not differing very much at all. Oh, this is a relaxation time. So we can actually measure this using an oscillatory shear experiment. We can't actually access, in most cases, the actual crossing point of G prime and G double prime, but we can extrapolate G prime and G double prime to higher frequencies to the point where they cross, right, with slopes of 1 and 2. And so we get it this way. We also get it from the onset of shear thinning from the viscosity function, and those two agree very nicely. Michael?
Well, if you take which way would you put
that's right. So I think if I understood what you said right, this concentration is way below where they really overlap, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit worrisome, right?
So you need to say that you need much, much higher concentrations than the simple argument suggests to see it. But they are a lot less entangled than the original simple argument.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so this gives you some idea of sort of how these things were determined experimentally. So this is a plot of specific viscosity as a function of concentration for this sodium PAMS polymer. So we have a region that's reasonably described by the Fuas law, which is something like C to the 1/2, and then something like C to the 3/2 here. Those lines are not quite C to the 1/2 and C to the 3/2, because in this system the correlation length's been measured, and so we can use the actual measured correlation length, which has a slightly weaker concentration dependence, which transfers to a slightly stronger concentration dependence here and here. But it fits the data reasonably, and this is essentially how we evaluate the concentration where entanglements start. This shows the same sort of analysis for the relaxation time. So the triangles are from oscillatory shear, and the solid circles are from steady shear measurements of this relaxation time that I just described earlier. So again, we pick off an apparent concentration where entanglements start. And really, the best way we found to try to evaluate this entanglement concentration is to fit it to a scaling form for different chain lengths. So we're essentially fitting this thing to this sort of an equation. Here's the unentangled part, and then when we have the entangled part, we have an extra factor of C over CE. And so we can plot the specific viscosity divided by the Fuas law part versus C over CE. We should get a universal curve, and we sort of shift C star and CE around until we get these things to fall, different data sets to fall on a universal curve. So the good news is the scaling sort of seems to work okay. But C star and CE clearly have very different dependences on chain length. Here shown as actually an exponential function of chain length instead of a power law. But the most important thing being that CE has a much weaker dependence on chain length than C star. Yes.
plumbing here.
Yes?
And you vary the length of the chain. Now, why should the entanglement monomer concentration depend on the total chain length? It's lost.
So you would expect this thing to be independent of concentration?
No, but
Well, no. I mean, if I sit at a given concentration and I start cutting chains in half and just continue to do it, eventually I'm going to wind up with an unentangled solution, right?
Yes, that's part of the entangled, then you come from a flat one, and then you go.
That's true. But you would say if the chains are much, I mean, they are very long, and then now we want to define some entanglement length. I mean, the monomer concentration, or is
yeah, I'm not understanding your puzzle. Yeah, I only have one other issue on this topic anyway. Okay, so this is the sort of picture we wind up with. So in theta solvent, we have two different concentration dependencies for the tube diameter and the correlation length, and the correlation length has the stronger concentration dependence. In good solvent, they have essentially the same concentration dependence, so they're parallel to each other. And in the polyelectrolyte, we have sort of the opposite case as the theta solvent. We have a stronger concentration dependence, apparently, for the tube diameter than for the correlation length. And for the theorists in the audience that were bored and were sleeping through the whole talk, they want to wake up now because this is this thing we don't have any theory for, right? So it would be, seems like a simple scaling law, right? Tube diameter inversely related to concentration. So come up with a model. Well, yeah, okay, so let's start with this cross. I mean, we're not sure what happens at this cross, right? Because we haven't gone to high enough molecular weight things to see, presumably these things sort of merge together or something. Yeah, this one, yeah, it looked like, let's see, yeah, it, yeah, they could. Right. At low enough n, so that's the problem, is that this line is now n dependent. Yeah. Yeah, okay. okay. Oh no! This particular one corresponds to CE going like n to the minus 2/3. So it's essentially the same as 0.6. So when I used the 0.6, I got something very close to 1. I said, well, I don't know it that well. I'll just call it 1. Yeah, but if you go back the other way, then it's 2. It's 2/3. Yeah, it's reasonable. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we don't have a lot of data for that, but it's reasonable. The only other thing so I'm done with this point. I have one other point I'd like to make, and that is that Ron Larson was asking a very important question of how do we define tau E? And so I thought I'd try to take a stab at that because Michael and I have been writing this book and tried to deal with this issue. And so this is a master curve of G prime and G double prime for an entangled polybutadiene melt. So we're completely switching topics here. And I claim the way to try to evaluate tau e is to not evaluate tau e at all, but to evaluate the relaxation time of the Kuhn monomer. And the way one evaluates that is from G prime. There's a, of course, since G prime is sort of a curving thing, there's some sort of region where it's roughly scaling like omega to the 1/2, which you'd expect for Rouse. And then it crosses to something that goes much steeper. It's not always exactly the slope of 3/4 that we might expect for stiff things from Dave Morse's ideas, but it's always considerably steeper than 2/3 or than 1/2. And so the intersection of these two scalings defines this monomer time. And then if you use the Doi fluctuation model, you actually can calculate the reptation time from that. You know how many entanglements you have on the chain, and you get an excellent prediction of the reptation time. And so then you have the courage to put the other two times on, which is the relaxation time of an entanglement strand and the Rouse time of the whole chain.
You might have done almost as well,
sorry? Well, I like this one because it's essentially what Ferry says to do in his book, actually, is fit the thing to a slope of a half, a tangent to the slope of a half. Sorry? No, but no, assuming fluctuations with the Doi model.
Right.
Say it again?
With what constraint release?
No constraint release.
I think constraint release is always irritation time by structural quality.
I can see that on this case.
Right.
Well, factor of 2 there is almost invisible.
Okay, but wait a second, Alexei. There's this old idea, you know, that if you have a blend of two long entangled chains, one longer than the other, you could calculate the reptation time of the long chain and the time scale for releasing all the constraints by the short chain. And you really have to have that a large difference between the chain lengths of the two before you start to see constraint release affecting the terminal time. So I don't understand.
It shifts both G prime and G double prime. It changes the shape. It doesn't, strictly speaking, it doesn't change terminal time. But it changes the algorithm. So the algorithm of extracting terminal time from G prime to double prime. Same, because you can constrain.
Alternatively, it says the reptation time, which doesn't depend on constraint release, is no longer the crossover of G prime and double prime.
If you this thing by model without constraint release, you always get reptation Rouse time factor of 2 here.
Okay, well, the real way to get the terminal time is to fit this thing to a slope of 2 and this thing to a slope of 1 and see where they intersect, right? I mean, this is an unambiguous way of for any no way. No, that's a definition. And for these data, the frequency where they cross is exactly numerically 1.001 times the other definition. So, yeah. Yeah. And that's true for any monodisperse polymer as long as there are enough entanglements on the chain.
Let's carry on this over lunch.
Okay.
Shall we just, some people finish at this point. Ralph, before I leave, you'll have to still open the door. Thank you, Ralph.
Certainly.